and welcome to the EOISS podcast, a conversation on foreign policy what-if scenarios. My name is Florence Gaub. I am the EOISS deputy director and the host of the show. And with me today, Sini Bukasari, our senior associate analyst who works, amongst other things, on Russia. Welcome, Sini.
Hello.
Sini, so you are taking us to the future today, not the far future, the near future. We are in September 2020, 4 months from the real now. Tell us a little bit about what happened between May and September 2020 in Russia.
So basically, in this imaginary scenario, during the next few months, the epicenter of the coronavirus epidemic would basically move from Moscow to different parts of Russia's massive landmass. While doing so, the death rate would very rapidly grow, and this would all highlight the huge differences in quality of healthcare services and quality of governance across Russia's 83 federal subjects and 11 time zones. So basically, this health crisis would then feed into more widespread discontent, and these problems would be then aggravated by increasing economic hardship, in particular in these deprived regions of Russia.
You said Russia has 11 time zones?
That is correct. Didn't you know that?
I knew that Russia was massive, but I didn't know it was that large. For the listeners, we're following one possible option. Obviously, there are others. But in the scenario that we're talking about here, a lot of people will die. I think you previously told me in the scenario about 30,000 people, but that a lot of people will believe that the real numbers are higher. So in this scenario where the virus has raged, what does this mean politically? I mean, Putin had a few things planned for the summer. How did the government deal with this crisis in your scenario?
Perhaps I should comment on the exact numbers of Russia's coronavirus cases, because basically Russia has very similar coronavirus case numbers to, for example, Italy, but it has very much lower numbers of deaths. Some of the sources of kind of, I don't know, doubts and conspiracy theories, perhaps Russia is not reporting, perhaps it's counting the numbers very differently from other states. And, you know, this is a source of speculation. But basically, when you are building a scenario, the numbers don't really matter that much. What I'm saying that we would see a massive increase, and also that it would highlight different problems. So it would be equation of health crisis, governance crisis, economic crisis that would then lead to different political pressure and perhaps turbulence. But in this scenario, basically, the Russian leadership on different levels, not only on the very high sort of federal level, but also in the regions, would very much fall into the old trap of very poor crisis leadership. They would react to the health crisis with a combination of threats and punishment, avoidance of responsibility, and manipulation of information, for example. So this is basically the pattern that we have actually seen in previous Russian crises, such as the Kursk submarine accident in 2000, and as well as the Beslan school hostage crisis in 2004. And of course, you know, in a more distant past, the Soviet past, you know, during the Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster in 1986. And I must say that these two crises that I mentioned, Kursk and Beslan, these are crises that were dealt by Putin himself. Putin, as a president, has never been a particularly gifted as a crisis leader. I think that he has very often seemed quite distant. He has almost like feared sort of the emotional reaction. So I don't think that he has ever kind of rose to be sort of Russia's Winston Churchill by any means, you know. He has been quite clumsy as a crisis leader.
So Moscow went into lockdown, and I think that's why perhaps the numbers there were comparatively low. But you also told me that the virus instead spread quite fast in provincial areas. So that's a little bit different from elsewhere in the world, right?
So basically, this is the scenario. I must emphasize that this is completely imaginary scenario, but this is really where the danger lies. Moscow is a very wealthy mega city with excellent health services. It is also a very advanced, smart city with very good control of movement and surveillance. It can kind of like control the movement of Muscovites very easily. Whereas the regions, I mean, it's a totally different story. And the quality of healthcare in Russian regions is often very, very poor. So they really don't have the resources to deal with such a crisis. And also the fact that, you know, not many people can afford to stay at home. So basically, I think it's very risky if the epicenter really moves from Moscow to less privileged neighborhoods in Russia. I would also say that there are actually already some signs that could point towards this kind of very negative spiral in Russia. For example, the manipulation of information as a kind of bad way to manage crises. On 1st of April, a law was passed that made spreading of disinformation about COVID-19 in Russia a criminal offense. I think that this sounds very reasonable and very innocent, but on this basis, it is possible to attack against healthcare workers or concerned citizens who have exposed critical shortages of protective equipment, for example, or, you know, healthcare related corruption and so on. And one has to remember the context also that in Russia, the judiciary is not independent from power structures. In this scenario, for example, the local judges would often protect the local authorities who would be responsible of the shortcomings and failings in the fight against the virus. This kind of like local networks of corruption can be very harmful when you are managing a crisis of this sort. And I think you can see the same pattern also on a higher level, because, you know, although President Putin has delegated the main responsibility of managing the crisis to the regional level, he has also threatened very directly the regional leaders that they could face criminal proceedings if they fail in their task. This is a kind of message that could actually encourage the regional leaders to hide and manipulate the information in case they are failing to meet their goals. So this could create, in fact, a very dangerous dynamic.
So in Russia, you face criminal charges if you fail at managing the coronavirus.
Well, I'm not saying that it is happening, but I'm saying that there is a possibility of that happening. There's been this kind of hint that, you know, you will be held responsible.
It reminds me a little bit of Iraq, where during the war with Iran, Saddam Hussein would execute generals if they didn't deliver the victory that he...
This is exactly that you're kind of avoiding responsibility by accusing others. And, you know, if everyone is doing the same, I mean, it won't help.
So the virus is bad news for everybody. We all had to postpone things, but for Putin personally, it's particularly bad, you told me. Why is that?
First of all, it of course ruined his very carefully orchestrated plans for this spring. I mean, we all know that in April the 22nd, there was supposed to be a kind of quasi-referendum, plebiscite on the planned constitutional amendments that would allow Putin to stay in power even after 2024. So now this plebiscite has been postponed, probably to autumn. Perhaps it could take place even in winter time, depending on how serious the political and economic crisis will be after the health crisis. And then the other thing that was planned for this spring was, of course, the 27th Victory Day parade in Moscow on 9th of May. And Putin was planning to host both Xi from China and President Macron from France. This would have been a very big sort of PR boost for him and I think for Russia overall. And that would be very symbolic kind of end of the diplomatic isolation that Russia has faced since 2014. This was a kind of a great loss for him, and I'm sure that he is very disappointed to see this. The second thing is really that it has had an impact on Putin's profile and standing and popularity even. So he really hasn't been the high commander in the fight against coronavirus, but has delegated the responsibility to the regional leaders, as we have already talked about. I think this is something that you wouldn't really expect in a country like Russia, you know, that is known for power vertical and, you know, Putin's manual control, basically micromanaging many minor political issues himself. We have already seen this reflecting negatively on his approval rating. For example, in February, his approval rating as a president was 69, in March, 63, and now in April, 59. I think that the numbers are pretty high, but nevertheless, they are record low for him. So in the Russian context, this is very low. And this is also very interesting in a sense that it goes against the trend that we have seen in many European countries, where at least in the very early stages of the crisis and lockdowns and so on, the incumbents' popularity rates have gone up after the virus has been spreading. Kind of, it seems that in crisis situation in many countries, you know, people look for authority that somehow gives very specific and clear guidelines for individual action, and perhaps in the best of cases, somehow pulls them together as a community. No, we are not really seeing this in Russia. Quite the contrary, at least on the federal level. We might actually see some of this same trend taking place on the regional level, which is very significant in a sense that usually in Russia, a president is the only kind of political institution that people seem to trust. But the lower you get and closer to the citizens themselves, the less there is trust in authorities.
That's the other way around than in Europe, because in Europe, statistics show or surveys show that people particularly trust municipal level governance.
It is exactly the opposite, because I mean, somehow like Putin is often seen as somehow like above the politics kind of figure, whereas the politics is like really dirty business and, you know, logo government. So it's exactly the opposite. Now this seems to be changing somewhat, like because now the approval rating for regional leadership was actually 61. And this is, you know, very exceptional for Russia.
And this is basically a little bit also this idea of this what if scenario, that if, you know, spirals out of control, kills a lot of people, although the regions are held responsible by Putin, it's actually Putin who's held responsible by the people.
We are just playing with different elements, obviously. But, you know, these are very interesting developments, nevertheless. And I think Putin might choose to react to these figures, for example, by taking more control and trying to appear as a sort of stronger figure in charge of the fight than later on. But at least so far, this is what the picture looks like at the moment as we speak.
Can we talk a bit about the economics? Because obviously everybody's paying a price as a COVID-19. Now, I know that when it comes to Russia, at least I've been told repeatedly by Russia experts that the economics don't play the same role in politics in Russia as they do elsewhere. What are the predictions or projections rather for how severely Russia will be hit?
I think that the current estimate vary between roughly 5% to 10% of loss of GDP for this year. And I think these numbers are very typical estimates for any European country. So there is nothing special in these numbers. If something, I think perhaps they might be a bit lower than for some European countries. But nevertheless, it has been predicted that, you know, Russia's economic recovery out of the crisis will be very slow unless significant structural reforms are carried out at the same time. Then it's important to highlight when we kind of estimate the economic price is the fact that, well, the context matters for, first of all, the crisis comes at very bad situation when the real disposable incomes of average Russians have been falling since 2014, and the quality of life of ordinary Russians have actually been slowly, I mean, not dramatically, but very slowly deteriorating. Two-thirds of Russians don't have any savings whatsoever, so there is very little buffer for, you know, normal average Russians. Then, of course, comes the second thing that should be highlighted is, of course, the dramatic fall in oil prices that has accompanied the crisis. It could be very temporary, but nevertheless, it has revealed severe vulnerabilities of Russia's state-driven economic model that really still continues to rely on the global demand of fossil fuels and, you know, is basically shaken to the root by every external shock out there. So I think this is kind of like what we know, the prediction is that volatility in the energy market, energy prices will increase in future, and that the energy prices will be quite low or at least moderate. This seems to indicate that we will see a lot of economic turbulence in Russia unless something is changed in kind of like if these kind of significant structural reforms are not carried out. This doesn't really help sort of Putin's standing and popularity at the moment when there is a growing sense that the economic model is not really delivering what it is supposed to deliver.
And we assume that he's not going to engage in these structural reforms, right? Why? Because he doesn't know how, or he doesn't...
I think that basically both options are open. I mean, it could go either way. So basically, the recovery strategy could continue to rely on the state-driven patriotic economic model, because Putin often kind of highlights the stability and the fact that the state can control the economic system, and basically the economy is not only producing wealth in economic terms, but it is also currency for Russia's foreign policy, for example. But then on the other hand, I mean, perhaps this vulnerability that has been revealed and is out in the open, this could also then create pressure to have more private sector driven, more pragmatic reforms, and there could be intensified attempts to diversify the economy. These options are both open, but I don't think that, you know, they are this kind of clear cut ideal models that you would choose. But rather, I think what we are talking about is that where is the main emphasis? So you probably are going to see elements of both models. And now I think that we clearly have the emphasis on the sort of patriotic economy model. So is it now time to shift the emphasis more to the other side? I don't know.
In the past, people thought when Russia does badly, or any state really does badly when it comes to the economy, that means that's a problem for the leadership. Russia defied this notion in the past. I mean, somebody honestly told me that Russians just don't expect the economy to do very well. So when it doesn't do well, then they're okay with it. Somehow I doubt that.
Well, I mean, there is a time and place for everything, I suppose. And, you know, if the quality of life has deteriorated for many years in a row, I'm sure that cannot go on forever. Although it could be that in 2014, there was a sense that we can sacrifice something for, you know, Krimnash and everything. Then perhaps, you know, that momentum has passed. And I think there is more and more indication of that momentum of passing, and also the priorities of average Russians shifting from foreign policy, for example, towards issues of well-being and economy and so on. So I think from foreign policy to domestic politics. You know, the interesting thing is that Russians don't generally trust the information provided by the authorities. So now, related to the COVID crisis, only 38% trusted official information fully or for the most part, while 59% did not trust the information at all or only trusted bits of it. While authorities can attack citizens for spreading information, for example, by doing Facebook posts or something like that, then at the same time, the state-controlled media outlets are also spreading disinformation and all sorts of conspiracy theories about the virus and its origins and so on. It's difficult to summarize because it's really, and again, we come to the same fact that it's about these kind of, you know, networks of power, in a sense that it's not just how the piece of legislation reads, but it's also how it plays out in practice in these circumstances and how, for example, authorities use and abuse those articles. So it is quite tricky. What this crisis does highlight, and what is a major handicap for Russia to cope with the crisis, is the fact that there are very low levels of social trust in Russia. They don't trust the capacity of healthcare system to cope with the crisis, but they also don't trust the information. So there is this kind of like web of distrust. For example, recently, Francis Fukuyama has also talked a lot how it doesn't really matter whether you have an authoritarian system or democracy. What really matters is the level of social trust within the society. So usually the most efficient countries are the ones where people trust the authorities and the information provided by them. It seems that the countries where this is not the case, such as the US, for example, and this is, of course, the case that Fukuyama is looking at, then, you know, the response is not as efficient and strong as in the other cases.
Russia uses the pandemic also to continue its disinformation campaigns in Europe. How is that good for Russia? Because it suffers from the same problem.
Well, I'm not sure whether they continue doing that, at least with the same activity as in the very early stages of the crisis. I think that they really saw an opportunity to play with the crisis and kind of like boost their own international standing quite cheaply and, you know, quite visibly. But I don't think this is any kind of massive, well thought out strategy that they will pursue also in the forthcoming months, even though we are seeing that it is getting quieter in that front, I think. This is not central part in my scenario. I looked at how Russia is coping with the crisis kind of internally.
So let's go back to your scenario. So Putin had to postpone his referendum. He delegated responsibility for managing the virus to the regional level. In your scenario, the municipal level benefits from this.
So basically, Moscow recovered quite quickly from the corona crisis and became symbol of efficiency and kind of a good fight against the virus. Moscow's mayor Sergei Sobyanin then rose to more national fame in a way that people even outside Moscow would recognize him and know him, and his political star would rise. In June, for example, this is now this imaginary scenario, his popularity rate nationally would be on the same level as President Putin's. Now, I must say that Sergei Sobyanin as a political figure has always been very staunch Putin loyalist. I don't think he has ever criticized Putin publicly, and he has always managed, for example, local elections according to, you know, the wishes of the federal leadership. I'm not saying that, you know, that he would really pose such a kind of a significant movement away from the Putin style governance, but nevertheless, I think that this could create tensions between political actors in Russia. So perhaps, you know, Sobyanin could somehow criticize the Russia's response to the crisis and perhaps be reprimanded by Putin afterwards. And there could be this kind of a bit of a competition in this setting. You know, there are some small signs already that could hint towards this dynamic developing, because, you know, Sobyanin has been seen in Russia as a very effective crisis leader, kind of straight talking, efficient, a bit brutal. And this used to be the role that was played by Putin himself. So in a way, we can see that the roles are shifting somehow, and Putin seems a bit more distant and perhaps standing on the sidelines. He's not in charge of the fight per se. So it seems that Sobyanin, his political star, is rising, and there is already some speculation in Russia that could he be Putin's successor? And to be honest, I think that this is quite premature, and I don't think that Putin necessarily likes that very much, because, I mean, this is too early for him to be a lame duck.
When is not too early?
What has been interesting in the crisis is exactly this, that Russia has always, or is very often seen as a country that is somehow stuck in the present, and it's very difficult to imagine a change in Russia, because, you know, somehow the whole political system is Russia. And also because the politics in Russia is always very carefully orchestrated play, and you have very little improvisation and everything is scripted. And this spring was very carefully scripted already. And now suddenly, because of the health crisis, the coronavirus crisis, the script was thrown into the rubbish bin. Suddenly, different political figures need to start improvising. And this is not very typical for Russia at all. Perhaps, you know, this is a momentum that reveals interesting dynamics that are happening and have been happening, but have been hidden from the public. And now we can peek under the curtains and see what's really going on.
Yeah, it's what you said, that basically those states that are very stiff and sclerotic, if you want, that now in this crisis have to move spontaneously.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for social scientists, I mean, it's not so much the health crisis itself that is interesting to observe, but it's much more that the COVID crisis is much more like a catalyst that somehow accelerates some existing trends, or to the contrary, it can then produce unexpected ruptures in the development or in the society. So, for example, I think it was already existing trend that there was growing discontent to Putin's leadership, but perhaps, you know, the crisis may have accelerated that. On the other hand, I think when it comes to unexpected ruptures, Putin had very carefully planned these constitutional amendments and the process, and also the fact that since the due date basically for succession is only 2024, you know, there's plenty of time to take care of the process. And now suddenly, still pretty early, but nevertheless, I mean, already the plans have been postponed and we don't know whether they will be materialized exactly in the form as intended. So there's been some unexpected ruptures as well.
So Russia remains a space to be watched. I also want to seize this opportunity to advertise the Pshayo paper that you and Stanislav are writing at the moment or putting together at the moment.
And it's about Russian futures. So Russian futures 2030. What kind of alternative futures can we see taking place, happening in Russia?
Thank you, Sini, for joining me today. Thank you for listening to us. And please join us again next Friday for another What If scenario.